Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us on this weekend edition of Trumpet Radio Live, 101.3 KPCG, and we're online at kpcg.fm. Record cold in much of the U.S. over this weekend. Make sure you bundle up. Some great career advice that isn't possible for many millennials to follow. We'll have details about that. You remember National Geographic? Yeah, they still exist. And their new issue is going to cover gender. So we'll see what that has to say. And the strange connection between Hollywood and guns. That and more, this edition of Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live, 101.3 KPCG. We are online at kpcg.fm. We have a live link at thetrumpet.com as well. You can follow us on Twitter at kpcgfm. And if you'd like to email us, please do that, comments at kpcg.fm. I'm Dwight Falk and Abraham Blondeau here again today. And lots of cold this weekend coming into the United States. Many areas are going to have some potentially record cold temperatures for this time of the year, including, most importantly, Chicago for the Bears-Packers game.
Right.
Very important. Most important part of it all, right? Sunday could mark the coldest Bears home game ever. That's saying something.
Yeah. I was trying to think of all the old footage I've seen of all the cold games in Chicago.
It was so cold, the cameras only recorded in black and white. Color didn't work. The Chicago Sun-Times says that Pernell McPhee, he's one of the Bears players, he still won't wear long sleeves. He'd be a tough guy. It says the outside linebacker told his fellow defenders as much, that it's a long-held Bears tradition to go bare-armed in cold weather no matter what. Sunday qualifies as just that, with the high expected to be 3 degrees. The Packers rivalry game with will rival the coldest Bears home games ever, so they're really close to that. The Bears' December 22nd, 2008 contest was the coldest so far at 2 degrees, so it could get there. The wind chill low of negative 15 happened on December 18th, 1983. Both games were against the Packers, so yeah, they're used to it, I guess, up there. The Bears prepared for the chill Thursday, stretching inside the Walter Payton Center. They had the doors open to try to get a little cold air in there, I guess. And then they spent the last 75 minutes of practice outside in single-digit temperatures, try to get acclimated. Rookie center Cody Whitehair was ashamed to admit that when the team got to the outdoor field, he put on a long-sleeve undershirt. he caved under the pressure. He said, at the end of the day, if it keeps me warm and healthy for the game day, that's important, and then hopefully I can not wear sleeves on game day. So everyone's got to be a tough guy out there, even though they're freezing.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I always like watching football games when it's cold because the big bravado of most football players diminishes very quickly. But the thing to remember about when you're playing extreme cold, whether you're wearing sleeves or not, as soon as you can't feel your arms anymore because they're so cold, that's the win. Because you don't want to go so far where it's hypothermia. But as soon as you can't feel the pain, you don't know they're cold anymore, and you can just go out and play, whether you're wearing sleeves or not.
Well, the other thing I think about when I watch those games and the guys have the exposed arms is how it would hurt to tackle somebody.
Right.
It hurt anyway. But when it's that cold, you know how it is. You get slapped on the skin. That's a hard thing. So you get hit with a helmet or something that's hard and cold like that. So that's can be quite painful. So that's what you can look forward to over the weekend if you like watching some of those football games. Cold, and of course, you know, if it's not that cold, you can warm up and do okay. That's pretty cold. And then if you get wind, I don't know what the wind is supposed to be, but it's always windy there. And if you get that wind whipping, it's hard to warm up when that cold wind's hitting you. I mean, even here, we're not getting, well, actually, we are going to get pretty cold over the weekend. They're talking about maybe 5 degrees for our low.
Yeah.
Their high is 3, so that's the difference. But still, it's hard to stay warm in that, especially if it's windy.
Yeah, especially when you're playing football, when you have to have minimal coverage, winter clothing. I remember during one football game I watched there when it was cold, they're talking about different strategies of how to keep their hands warm. And some players would wear surgical gloves under their normal football gloves to try to keep their hands warm. And I guess that worked well.
Yeah, well, then they have the little heater things that they'll put in their coat pocket or something right. to try to keep, especially if you're a quarterback or you're a receiver, you've got to stay, you know, keep your hands warm. And then the punters too.
Yeah.
The pretty boy punters come off the sideline. They're always, they have huge coats on and,
yeah.
and everything. So, you know, there used to be barefoot kickers. You don't see that very much anymore, but there'd be barefoot field goal kickers. And I always thought, boy, that would just be so painful. And the reason I thought that is because I actually, when I was a kid, I used to watch them and I thought, wow, you could probably kick the ball further barefoot. That must be why they do it.
Yeah.
So I went outside in Wisconsin in probably December. It was snow on the ground. I took my shoe and my sock off, and I just kicked the ball as hard as I could. It was one of the most painful things. I thought I shattered my foot. Never again. Never again would I do that.
It was like kicking a bowling ball. Like that yeah. ball gets frozen. And man, because I mean, I've taken hockey pucks to the shins and that kind of thing, and that hurts enough when you're just wearing like one little layer of clothing, but kicking something as hard as you can that's really hard. It's
a bad idea.
Yeah.
Yeah. So a cold weekend, and hopefully you can stay bundled up and stay warm. We had quite a few accidents here recently. Got some freezing rain, I guess, Thursday night. The last statistics I saw in the Oklahoma City area, there was over 100 accidents that had injury. And then there were 3 fatalities. I don't know if that number has changed. But pretty serious, some of the driving. It wasn't a heavy rain. It was just a real light kind of mist, but it froze on the bridges, on the overpasses. And it got to the point where they couldn't respond to accidents anymore unless they were injury. So you're out of luck if you just went off the road and just had to sit there until something could happen. But they couldn't come help you because they had to go to the accidents that had injury. So pretty serious traveling conditions.
Yeah, that's the danger. I mean, Thursday night when I was driving around, it would freeze on the windshield and you have to get it off. But the ground, it would melt when it hit the ground. But I didn't go over any bridges. But that's the key, is those the interstate overpasses, especially in Oklahoma City, there's a lot of overpasses and that kind of thing. And when you're going, some people would still go 60 miles an hour, even with the conditions, and that's just asking for trouble.
Yeah, so they showed a lot of the, you know, the different cameras that showed the highways. And I was watching it thinking, I'm so glad I'm not out there.
Yeah.
Glad to be sitting here watching that on TV, because really slow going and then just very slippery. And then a lot of the accidents are multiple vehicle. I mean, maybe you didn't slip, but the guy behind you did, and now all of a sudden you're in this chain reaction. So going to be traveling conditions like that in some parts of the U.S., so be careful when you're heading out. This is an interesting story. This is from CNBC.com. The Atlanta Braves general manager has some career advice that's making young people cringe. The drama started, they say, with an innocent Twitter question and answer during which Atlanta Braves general manager John Coppola took over the baseball team's general account to answer fans' questions. So typically he wouldn't be on their Twitter, but he said, I'll take it over for a little while. You can ask me questions. I'll answer them. And there was some basic back and forth about players and so forth. Then one fan asked the baseball manager for career advice, and I think he gave great advice here. He said, look for internships. Don't worry about the money. Work hard. And don't have expectations beyond being part of a team. Assume nothing. And that made people very upset. Are you surprised by that? That they'd be upset?
A little bit, because I see that kind of language on almost every motivational poster I've ever seen in my life. So
maybe he was just typing that what was on the wall in front of him.
Yeah.
Yeah, the reason they were not impressed, some of them, was, well, a couple of reasons. This one person responded and said sarcastically, oh, this is great career advice. I've always wanted to make no money, have little self-worth, and be undervalued. Well, that's a pretty arrogant way to take his comments. He's not saying just be an intern the rest of your life. He's saying get your foot in the door, come in with a humble attitude, and then go from there. But it's hard for people to do that. Because of ego sometimes, but also because of this. The average college graduate leaves campus with more than $27,000 in debt. You owe $27,000 on your education. You can't afford to take an internship. Yeah. You need the big job, and they're just not out there out of the gate usually.
Yeah, that's student debt is one of the major problems in America, especially the way people who loan that money make it so easy to take for young people who most of them have not made a lot of financial decisions in their life. So it looks very alluring. But like you said, I think a lot of it too is to get to the big job, you usually have to start at the very bottom and work your way up. And that takes time, a lot of effort, facing disappointment, realizing that you don't know that much and you have to learn a lot along the way. And you don't really see too many people like that. And they are out there for sure. But it's just not as common as it used to be.
Right. I mean, because when you're coming into a new job or a new career, even if you have your degree, well, probably everybody there has theirs too. And they've been doing the job for 15 years. So yeah. Are they all supposed to just, well, here you come, get out of the way and, you know,
yeah.
Turn on the confetti machine. Yeah, you have to work your way up. You've got to learn some things. But they're in a tough spot because they're $27,000 in debt on average. It impacts their job decisions, such as whether or not to take a low-paying internship. They just have to live at home a lot of times, and they don't have the freedom to go out and learn a little bit, try a few things, because they already owe money. Really dangerous situation. They say, in fact, a 2016 Go Banking Rate survey reveals about 70% of millennials have less than $1,000 in their savings, so no money. And they need money and need it fast, and the jobs just aren't there to get it to them immediately.
Yeah, and I think this highlights a big problem where young people become victims of that. I mean, some of it's their own fault, but it's the system we have in place, and that's that the way we view economics, student debt, university, is that we're sacrificing future generations for our livelihoods right now. Because with the way debt works and the way the U.S. economy works, we're saying, well, down the road, we'll have to pay all this back. Down the road, we'll have big interest problems. But right now, things are good, and that's all that's important. And that's even the way people approach education, where, well, I'll be in college right now, I'll get education, and I'll pay back that debt later. Well, as this study shows, and this article shows really well, that's very, very difficult. And once you get into that hole, it's almost impossible to climb out unless you get lucky, or unless you just work really hard for a long time.
Yeah, they say many millennials, particularly those aged 26 to 35 who carry significant debt burdens, are delaying home ownership and instead paying historically high rents to live in cities where the only available jobs are. So it's this weird cycle. They're in debt, so they need to make more money. So they'll go to where they can find a higher paying job. But the higher paying job comes with a higher cost of living. So you have to pay historically high rents because you can't afford to buy a home. And so it's just kind of a cycle, and a bad one at that. And you just get in this trap of heavy debt, needing to make a high income to pay the debt, but paying more for everything along the way as well. And so it would be, it's funny if you think about coming out of college with a degree and owing $27,000. Or if somebody said to you, here's $27,000. Like, which one would you take? The cash or the debt and the education?
Yeah.
Some people would say the education, but it's like you'd be better off to pay your way as you go if you could. Everyone's in a hurry to get it done, but really, the older you get, you look back and think, you didn't need to be in such a hurry. You could have taken your time, paid for things as you could, go as you can, and then you get out with your education still probably, maybe it'll take you a little longer, but you wouldn't have that massive debt sitting there.
Yeah, exactly. And even scholarships are always a good way to go because that does help a lot.
We're not all as smart as you, Abraham. Yeah, I'm kidding.
I didn't get any scholarships. So,
no, it is. If you can get it, but, or grants, or there's a lot of financial aid for people. So that's a good point.
Yeah, if you can start off with those, that can help alleviate the debt a lot. But as you mentioned, the common trend, I mean, when I left high school, there was a lot of pressure. You got to go to university. Like even career class, they said, okay, pick two universities, apply to them today. And if you accept it, you don't have to go, but just so you can get the ball rolling on that. So there's a lot of pressure to go to university right away. And for good reason, you're young. That's a good time to go and all this. But the problem is, like you said, with the debt. And you can end up costing your livelihood in the future for the education, which may not pay off in the long run. So you do have to weigh everything in the balance and try to make the best decision.
Yeah, and a lot of times if you can start out at a college close to home, maybe a community school or something, then you can maybe live at home. There's ways to not have to get into such debt, because a lot of that debt's not paying for the courses. It's paying for your living expenses, kind of the whole college experience. And there's sort of this idea with some, I guess, that you know, college is going to be this four to eight year, depending on what you're doing. Just kind of fun time. It's a time of my life. You know, we're going to go have this college experience. We'll put it all on the tab and we'll pay for it later when we get the big job. But then you're saddled with all this debt, and sometimes you don't get the big job.
Yeah, and even yesterday, what we talked about with the free speech spaces on U.S. campuses,
right,
even that experience that you're paying a lot of money for isn't that good, where highly volatile political environments, a lot of pressures, a lot of controversy, where a lot of people probably don't care. They're just trying to mind their own business, get on with their life, get out of school so they can make some money and start a family or whatever they're doing. But a lot of them get caught in the crossfire, or they just get dragged into these situations where you get $27,000 worth of debt to live through 4 years of being in riots or looking out your window on campus and seeing students protesting. Like, is that the kind of good learning environment? Probably not.
Well, right. And this report doesn't talk about the type of degrees people are getting. You know, some are worth more than others.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, if you're coming out with a hard science degree and then you could really put to a practical skill, well, okay, you know, there might be something to that. But if you're coming out with like I don't know, there's all kinds of degrees that might not be as valuable as others. So
yeah,
hard to say. But anyway, that's a lot of debt, and people aren't able to take the internships that they would like. But that means there's more internships available for those who want to take them. It's a great way to learn. I had a few, and some of my greatest learning experiences were at those internships.
Yeah, I never had the opportunity, but all the programs I was looking at besides Armstrong College were internships, because they were cheaper and you got to work your way through them too. Like, you actually get paid money,
right,
for them. So,
mm-hmm.
And that seemed a lot more appealing than just having to bite the bullet on costs.
Right. And it gives you practical experience too. Because sometimes people go to school for a particular field and then they've never done it though. And then they get out and they get into it and they realize, I don't really like this.
Yeah.
You know? Here's a really interesting development. This could be something, I guess, as far as a medical breakthrough of some kind. Burn victim covered with fish skin in pioneering new treatment. Brazilian doctors are using the skin of a tropical fish to treat burn victims in a pioneering new therapy that is significantly reducing the trauma suffered by survivors. I think we've all seen people that have had burns, and it's a pretty bad deal. It says, it's the first time in medical history that researchers have used the skin of an aquatic animal as a band-aid to treat lesions. When a gas cooker canister exploded in an accident at this one restaurant over there, this person got hurt, causing second-degree burns to her arms, neck, and some of her face. Doctors offered an alternative therapy to the conventional ointment-based one to dress her wounds with the skin of a tilapia fish. And supposedly, it's supposed to be pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, I've eaten lots of tilapia, but I've never considered using its skin for anything.
You've been throwing the skin away.
Yeah.
Well, they say that, I don't know, they didn't have a lot of scientific facts about what's happening there, but they did say that it is supposed to make the treatment less painful and have better results at the end. I mean, fish has all that good oil in it, the omega-3s or whatever
yeah.
it is.
Yeah.
So I don't know much about the science other than it's oily. Seems yeah. like it might work, but it's kind of interesting. You know, it's funny, too. They had a picture of just the skin, the fish skin on the arm. It looked like, I thought it was tattoos.
Right. Yeah.
It looked like somebody had a lot of tattoos on their arm. It was tilapia skin.
Yeah, that's really interesting, and I can see it's because the oil-based or ointment-based treatments, those are all chemically produced, and even if they use natural products in them, they're still manufactured. So probably has some things that aren't natural. And so maybe the fish skin does everything, but without any chemical side effects and in a more natural way. So that would be really great, because I know burn victims, usually the hardest part of it is like disfigurement or just a lot of terrible skin problems. So if that's going to help alleviate it in some way, that would be awesome.
They'll probably never eat fish again.
Yeah, you know? That's true.
Anyone want tilapia? No, not me. I've been in their skin. This is a sad story, but it's kind of probably a warning. from CNN. Boy dies building a snow fort. This happened in New York, in Greenwich. 13-year-old boy died when the snowbank he was playing under collapsed. The snowbank was left behind by a snowplow, went by, big snowbank, and him and another buddy were making a snow fort. It collapsed on them. The other boy survived. He has hypothermia. He's being treated for that in a hospital. But the one kid did die, 13-year-old. Yeah, growing up in a very snowy region like I did, we used to have tunnels and forts. And I do remember thinking occasionally, like, I wonder what would happen if this thing collapsed on us. So something to keep in mind if your kids are out playing, to make sure they're being safe, I guess.
Yeah, always a somber reminder because, I mean, all kids like playing in snow as part of childhood and all that, but it can be dangerous. And usually it takes something like this to remind us about that, unfortunately. But yeah, it's, I think my parents told me or hearing in school that if you are playing in something like that, always keep part of your body exposed out of the snow fort. So if it does collapse, people can see that something's wrong.
Somebody's in there. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's something that, always try to keep in mind, or just my parents' band making, like, snow forts going underneath them. You can make a fort, but nothing with a roof, just right, in case that happened.
Yeah, we'd have it where it would, you know, it would be sticky for a while, and then it would freeze hard, and then it would be there for a long time. But then in the spring or whenever it warmed up a little bit, it would start to fall apart, and you'd have to be careful. I mean, because I don't think it happens too often, but it could certainly happen. So something to keep in mind there. Of course, this next one happened. You remember that band from the 90s? Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Oh yes, of course.
I think they're still around in some yep, fashion. It's always funny when those, like, sort of teenage icons get older, though, because they're old people now, but they're still trying to look like they're younger.
Yeah.
Not related to the story at all. I just think that's an interesting thing.
Yeah, like, no, it's true. They act like teenagers, even though they're like, yeah, you're 60. Why are you
right,
trying to appeal to like a 13-year-old? Like, shouldn't you move on or something like that?
That's like the joke is they call the Rolling Stones like the Rolling Bones or something right, like that. They're all in their 70s.
Yeah.
They're still playing their rock music. Anyhow, there was a bit of a problem here with one of the members of the Red Hot Chili Peppers, his wife. This is stranger than you could just even dream up, I guess. Their kids attend school with the kids of Scott Baio, who is,
okay,
he's like an actor from the 80s, 90s. I don't totally know what he was in, but he was in something. So Scott Baio was attacked by the wife of the Red Hot Chili Pepper member. And she's not only facing a sheriff's investigation, she's also dealing with a school full of angry parents demanding the school drop the hammer on her. They got into a fight over Donald Trump. Everyone's blaming Donald Trump for everything. And this comes from a TMZ, which is not the best source, but it was kind of an interesting headline. Sources close to the situation tell TMZ. Nancy Mack, that's the lady's name, she's a wife of Red Hot Chili Peppers drummer Chad Smith, could be looking at a possible ban from all school functions after she went off on Scott Baio for supporting Donald Trump. So Scott Baio supports Donald Trump. She does not. We're told parents were livid and filed complaints with school officials. Scott Baio told the police that Nancy continually shouted a inappropriate phrase that Donald Trump was famous for while making a scene at their kids' elementary school event. So here you are at your elementary school. They're having an event, and these two get into a fight over Donald Trump.
Yeah, not the best scenery for an elementary school. I think probably any kids of famous people or semi-famous people in the case of Scott Baio is that they're probably already kind of ostracized anyway, so, or resented against or something like that. So this is a good opportunity to, I don't know, level the playing field. But also you can't do that in elementary school. I mean, come on.
It just shows you the maturity level here.
Yeah.
They say an official at the private school wouldn't say what, if any, punitive action it would take against Mac, but said our highest priority is the safety and privacy of our children and their families. The ironic part about this, or more ironic part, I guess, the alleged physical confrontation between Nancy and Scott went down at a school play where students said Merry Christmas in more than 10 languages. And you got Scott Baio and the wife of Chad Smith, the drummer from the Red Hot Chili Peppers, fighting and yelling about Donald Trump. It's like a movie. It's like a bad movie.
Yeah. I just wonder how that came up during the Christmas play.
I don't know.
But it does remind me of SNL did a skit for Thanksgiving, or Jimmy Fallon, might have been Jimmy Fallon, about politically correct Thanksgiving, how it was offending everyone. But that's kind of like with this, where Christmas is about unity, I guess, and all those good feelings people are having this time of year, but ends up resulting in a fist fight between a woman and a man about Donald Trump.
Unbelievable. And she was yelling all kinds of crazy things. I just can't imagine the kids. You'd just be looking at that like, wow. Maybe they're used to it in their households.
Yeah. Like, what language is that in Christmas? Merry Christmas.
That's not what she said to him. She said something else. Well, of course, the political landscape changing. This is an interesting story here. Michelle Obama's got some commentary. She talked to Oprah Winfrey, and she said, "We are feeling what not having hope feels like." That's a weird sentence.
Yes.
"We're feeling what not having hope feels like." She's feeling a feel.
She has all the feels.
All the feelings. Following the election of Donald Trump, Michelle Obama said many Americans now, apparently she's talked to people, now know what it's like not to have hope. It's the first time, apparently, in the history of man. She said, "We feel the difference now. See, now we are feeling what not having hope feels like." She told Oprah Winfrey, "Hope is necessary. It's a necessary concept, and Barack didn't just talk about hope because he thought it was just a nice slogan to get votes. He and I and so many believe that. What else do you have if you don't have hope?" Well, that's a good question. She said, "What do you give your kids if you can't give them hope?" True. I don't think there's a lot of hope in Syria right now.
Nope.
I do remember a particular quote that the president made from 2012, where he said, in regard to Syria, "We have been very clear to the Assad regime, but also to other players on the ground, that a red line for us is we start seeing a whole bunch of chemical weapons moving around or being utilized. That would change my calculus. That would change my equation." So nothing was done about that. Chemical weapons were used on children. We have this footage of that all over. We have a story about what's going on over there a little later as well. So it sounds nice, and it is a nice thing to say that, yes, what do you give your kids if you don't give them hope? What about the kids in Syria, though?
When you have to take in consideration, well, how much hope does, like you said, all these other people around the world have after 8 years of President Obama?
Yeah, and that's not, I mean, there's always problems, and it's not like it's just one person that causes it or doesn't. But to make the point or that they're making that, well, there was hope with him, now there's no hope. That's crazy talk. She also says, "I feel Barack has been that for the nation in ways that people will come to appreciate." So we don't appreciate it yet, I guess. "Having a grown-up in the White House who can say to you in times of crisis and turmoil, hey, it's going to be okay. Let's remember the good things that we have." I don't remember that ever being said. I do remember this being said when the officers were being gunned down. The president said, "I think it's fair to say we will see more tension between police and communities this month, next year, and for quite some time." I don't remember him saying, "Let's remember the good things that we have."
Yeah, and the kind of hope she's talking about is giving hope to the Black Lives Matter, that they can get their way around the country. Or it's just amazing that she claims that he speaks for all Americans or all people, or that he's the reason why certain crises were avoided, when in fact, as you said, there's plenty of other statements as well to where he incited a lot more problems in a moment of crisis where he did not. It just exit with Trayvon Martin saying, "Oh, my son would have looked like Trayvon." All these things that just made everything so much worse than it had to be, when in each of those cases, the officers were acquitted of charges because they did no wrong, or George Zimmerman in that case. So who's giving hope, and who's the grown-up in the White House who's actually inciting or making things worse for America?
Well, of course, and the insinuation there is that the next person that comes in is not a grown-up or something. And if anyone's interested in the Bible, I mean, it does say that, you know, cursed be the man that trusts in man. If you're going to put your hope in man, I don't care who he is, you got a pretty hopeless future. So, but not according to what she says. So yeah. She has a differing view, I guess, than what the Bible thinks there.
Yeah, and even a a lot of prophecy on thetrump.com. A lot of articles point out the prophecy in Isaiah 3, just about how our leaders are acting like children.
Yeah.
And I mean, that is, the level that at Donald Trump for a lot of things he has said and done, or a little more childless, I guess, and not mature or of the stature of the top executive in the land. But like you mentioned, the main lesson from all this is that no man can solve these problems or govern man. And that will prove true with Donald Trump, but there's a lot of proof over the last 8 years with Barack Obama that that's definitely true.
Yeah. Yep, for sure. So there's some really good write-ups at thetrumpet.com. Great Again and America Under Attack. So make sure you check those out at thetrumpet.com. They're free. Key of David program is coming up here in a bit on KPCG. Two programs over the weekend, the two newest ones. Make sure you listen for those. Also, the Trumpet Daily Radio Show with your host, Stephen Fleury from Edstone, England. Lots of topics today, talking about Europe, what's going on over there, some of the things that are happening. Lots happening in Germany and Europe, lots of moving pieces. Of course, an election coming up here in, I guess, a year or so. And just a change. The EU isn't what it used to be, and they're not quite sure what it's going to end up as. But the pieces are moving, and the Trumpet's written a lot about what you can expect to see it move into. So it's pretty interesting over there.
Yeah, it's a formulative time for the European Union. I mean, it's been around for a long time. And there's been a lot of different leaders come through, a lot of different statements about what the European Union should be. But it's always been kind of a stagnant group, a lot of infighting. But now all those circumstances have changed, where there's a lot of crisis. The United States is retreating. And so you're seeing Europe take on a character we haven't seen for a long time. And that fits in with Bible prophecy, but also it's a more dangerous time. And that's one thing that a lot of secular analysts don't see, is what's going to happen with Europe. Is it going to stay an ally of the West, as has been since it was defeated in World War II, or is it all going to change?
It's a lot moving there, so make sure you listen for that Trumpet Daily Radio Show. And if you can't catch it live or a replay, you can get the archives online at kpcg.fm. You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live. We're at 101.3 KPCG. We have a live stream at kpcg.fm. And if you'd like to follow us on Twitter, please do that at kpcgfm. Also send any emails you have, questions, comments, so forth. Comments at kpcg.fm. You remember National Geographic magazine?
Yes.
Yeah. Those are always around somewhere in the library. They're always discovering a tribe that no one's ever seen before. Every issue, they discover a new tribe. Where have they been hiding? How do they keep finding all these people?
Yeah, it's a... I always admire... I never really read a lot of National Geographic. I always just admire the photography. Just great pictures. And like you mentioned, finding these indigenous tribes hiding in like Central Park in New York City that we could never find before.
They always found something. Well, they're covering a new topic now. They're jumping right into the social changes. National Geographic makes history with the transgender cover. Well, they say girl, but I guess it's a boy. I'm not sure what it is. And it's a young person. The gender revolution issue, that's what it's called, which hits newsstands nationwide on December 27th, examines, quote, the cultural, social, biological, and personal aspects of gender identity, according to a press release. Features include an article called Dangerous Lives of Girls, which follows the lives of young women in Sierra Leone, and Rethinking Gender, which examines how science can help navigate the shifting landscape of gender identity. So this is like the new frontier, right? And they keep pushing the topic and the subject, and National Geographic's jumping in now with it as well on December 27th.
Yeah, this is really interesting for a scientific journal to take up the cause of social policies and social justice, I guess. And I mean, this is, I'm sure some of the articles are, I mean, like girls in Sierra Leone, that's a very important subject people should know about, with just the terrible war crimes going on in that country. Warlords enslaving young women as child soldiers, that kind of thing. That's been going on for a long time. So it's good to bring attention to those issues. But when you turn it into a light of this social justice where transgender are their own people, their own race, their own equal in rights to anyone else. You go outside the realm of science and into the realm of politics. And I think that's going to be a fatal error for National Geographic, because I don't think that's why people read them. It's not for their political views. And it'll just be interesting to see if others jump on that course as well, other scientific journals.
Yeah, and I would think they're trying to make a splash because magazine sales are down in general. I don't know about theirs, but they're probably trying to make a splash as well. National Geographic's editor-in-chief Susan Goldberg told NBC, NBC out, I don't know what that is, that doesn't sound great, that the magazine's staff was inspired by gender's omnipresence in the national conversation in creating the issue. She said, "We wanted to look at how traditional gender roles play out all over the world, but also look into gender as a spectrum. There's lots of coverage on celebrities, but there wasn't an understanding on real people." She means celebrities aren't real people. That's a shot at the celebrities.
That's right.
She says, "And the issues we face every day in classrooms or workplaces in regards to gender." The issue comes just ahead of the release of a 2-hour documentary, Gender Revolution, A Journey with Katie Couric. Is she changing her gender?
I don't know.
It's a revolution. Yeah. they say, which will cover everything you wanted to know about gender, but were afraid to ask. Are you a guy or a girl? Is that the question we're going to ask and answer? That documentary will debut on National Geographic on February 6th. So they're jumping on board with this and pushing that issue. And the person on the cover, I think, is a child. And I think it's, I don't know what it is, a boy that's trying to be a girl. I think that's what it is. I don't remember the age. I think it was pretty young. And, you know, they do that. They take their nice picture and they try to make the person look nice. And it's a young person. And but they don't often look at somebody who's gone that direction their whole lives. And now towards the end, you know, what was it like? What happened for you? Was it a good situation? You happy? They don't often look at that side of it. They often look at the very young people. And so I don't know what they're all going to put in there, but I would venture to guess that they're very pro neutral gender society, or whatever you'd want to call it, where everyone's just kind of picking as they go, picking and choosing. Does anybody think that's going to end well? A society going that direction, does anyone think that ends well? Historically, people could say, well, we don't know, it hasn't happened. But yeah, it has. Sure it has.
Yeah.
Because if you go into, if you just look at the Old Testament, where Israel came into the Promised Land, God laid out very specific things and said, the people here are doing this, 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 and this. Don't do that. And you can find about everything in there. So this isn't new, and it doesn't end well.
Yeah, it's a great point, and that is the interesting thing. If you do look at the history of gender, transgender, how they've been treated through the centuries, a lot of people will think they were mistreated, etc., and no doubt they were, cruelly sometimes. But at the same time, there's a reason why in the Bible, and never mind what man does, that's always suspect, like we talked about. But what does the Bible say about these issues of morality? And that should be our guiding force in this discussion. But also, like you said, it's interesting that those who run the National Geographic, the Susan Goldberg and the top executive editors, they're a product of the education system. And in the article I wrote this week on The Trumpet, The War in History, gender studies in universities have gone up 797% since 1975. So over the last 30 years, they've gone up that much in the share of the faculty at universities. So instead of 1% of teachers in universities focusing on gender in 1975, it's up to 10% today. So there's a huge focus in university about teaching young people about exactly what's in National Geographic.
And that's a great point, because what does this documentary do, or this issue do? It educates. It educates people, young people. Especially older people, I don't think it's swayed as much by that type of thing. But younger people, it educates them and it says, hey, did you ever think about doing this? How about this? What about trying this? There's all kinds of things that you could talk about, but you probably shouldn't talk about, because they're heading the wrong direction. But that's really what they're doing here, is they say, well, we're just exploring it. Yeah, sure you are. You're educating people and you're telling them, you should look into this. And that doesn't end well.
Yeah, exactly. And it what it does, even it's a form of revisionist history, which is very clever. Because if you can present something in a historical light and show some kind of progress or something, you trick people into thinking that, and this is a strategy used by anyone who's trying to sell certain ideologies, especially eugenics in Germany before World War One, World War Two, as they would rewrite history or present history in a way that makes their subject look presentable or like the superior moral issue. And that's what this documentary is really going to do, I think, is it young people, if they don't know the other side of the history, they'll see the history of gender as like, oh, well, we're progressing, we're getting better morally, we're getting more intelligent, and so this is just a natural result of history, and so this is something we should support. But if you don't know the history of this kind of stuff, you can be swayed by that when it's actually very brutal. I mean, just one example, some Roman emperors, one in particular, who built a wall in between Scotland and England, he had a relationship with a young boy when he was emperor of Rome, and he forced him to get a sex change back in the like this early ADs, hundreds AD. Now that's the history of transgender. I mean, and this talk we're not talking about modern medicine here. This is pre Dark Ages type medical stuff. Now for that boy, he had a terrible life, but it was forced upon him by the most powerful man in the world. And that's just a small sliver of the kind of stuff that went on through history with this kind of thing. So to me, just when you talk about this stuff, that's the foreground to what's going on today, where it's getting more accepted. But it's just a lot of terrible history.
Yeah, it really is. And like they talk about, oh, they have a great cover and they made it look great. Well, yeah, they made it look great, but it's not the truth of the matter. And we have a really good book that you need to read about that topic in general, I guess, is Redefining Family, which is at thetrumpet.com. It's a free one. It's amazing. It's almost behind the times. I mean, it's not because of the principles are right and great, but things change so quickly that the next thing is already on the horizon. You've got a write-up here from Commentary Magazine dealing with Syria. Aleppo's fall won't end the war. Everyone's waiting for the Syria thing to finally stop. Headlines today saying people trying to escape are being gunned down by Assad's regime. How would you like that? Not a very hopeful situation. So
yeah.
What's going on here with Aleppo?
Yeah, this is an interesting situation because Aleppo, one of the biggest cities in Syria, a lot of coverage of the battle going on. And with the help of Russia, Assad's been able to reclaim pretty much the entire city. The battle's coming to an end. The rebels and civilians who are trying to escape are being slaughtered, even though Russia made an agreement with the U.S. about this, but the other parties aren't agreeing to it, and that's no big surprise there. But that this battle, the end of the Battle of Aleppo, doesn't mean anything. And although it's this is just one of the worst events of the 21st century, I think, in terms of a humanitarian crisis, like of the carnage of war, it's just a small sliver of what could happen. And Max Boot, he goes through some of the history in the region, and
I love that name, by the way,
Max Boot.
Yeah,
it's rolls off the tongue.
It does
the Lebanese civil war went on for 16 years, and it was much the same as this one. And even though Assad captured Aleppo, ISIS still controls most of eastern Syria. The Kurds are there. Donald Trump says he's probably going to cut off U.S. supplies to the rebels, U.S.-backed rebels in Syria. And Assad said he's no interest in fighting ISIS. So it looks like this war is just going to go on for a long time. And just so far in this war that's been going on for about 6 years, about 500,000 people have been killed, so 500,000. 11 million people are displaced from their homes. 5 million have fled the country, to Europe and other places. And we're just having the worst war crimes we've seen since Rwanda and Darfur in Sudan.
And this is a time, apparently, harkening back to an earlier story, where you just need somebody to say, don't worry, it'll be okay.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, what kind of hope can words bring when this is, these are the facts,
right?
This happening to millions of people. And in this article, Max Boot lays with the war crimes. He lies. He points them at three men in particular: Bashar Assad, Ayatollah al-Khamenei, and Vladimir Putin, because they're the three who have been targeting civilians. Russia supplies the air power, and they have some troops there, but mainly air power. And they've been indiscriminately killing civilians with the airstrikes. In Iran, they've supplied up to 5,000, or sorry, up to 8,000 paramilitary assets. So those are paramilitary assets, are soldiers who, they're not working for any country. They're just contractors, like soldiers of fortune, mercenaries. So Iran has supplied 8,000 soldiers to Assad from Afghanistan, Lebanon, Iran, a bunch of different places. And you have Assad himself, who's just been mowing down people with chemical weapons and barrel bombs, all these terrible things. And those are the people who are getting empowered here in this situation. And that's the worst thing that happened.
Yeah, I mean, there's a really good point that was brought out by Key of David presenter Gerald Fleury on the show that he has just taped, and it'll air next weekend. And he mentions some of the things that you see going on over there. And if you understand biblical prophecy, we're entering into or are into the times of the Gentiles. And that this is a small, small foretaste of what you get when you have Gentile warfare. They don't care. It doesn't matter about civilians. Civilian, not a civilian, what do we care? You know, it's power, absolute power, and destroy anybody that's in your path. That's what you see, and we're seeing that on a small scale in Syria. Magnify that around other countries. You know, people are used to the United States and Britain and Israel in the Middle East. Most nations don't act that way. Be careful. Yeah. You know, people need to be careful what they wish for. You don't want the U.S. involved anymore? Fair enough, but now you're going to have Russia involved. See which one you prefer.
Yeah, exactly. That's a great point. And this is just a small foretaste of how modern warfare is fought in cities. Because with the modern armaments, which are so powerful, this is the kind of destruction you'll see in any city in the world if this kind of warfare happens there. And let's contrast this to America and Iraq. That's the most recent example of America fighting in a similar situation. When American troops would go into a city, much like Assad is to try to conquer it, American soldiers would go house to house. They wouldn't pre-bomb anything, so they wouldn't kill civilians. They go house to house. They would risk being shot when they entered the house, so they wouldn't shoot civilians. They would hold back for a second to make sure they just didn't shoot anyone in the house. They would even go to the if they were using a house for cover, they would take all the possessions in the house and protect them in the basement or cover them with blankets when they're being shot at by the enemy. They went to extraordinary lengths to protect civilians, to even just protect their property, and just give aid to people who were being shot, allowing them to escape, giving them food, giving them their own rations. A lot of soldiers went hungry because they would give the starving Iraqis their own food. So you have that kind of warfare, which the media criticized like crazy. Or you can have like this, where you have 500,000 people dead through indiscriminate bombings, chemical weapons, just mass executions. And that's the contrast. So if America retreats like a lot of people want it to, you're going to have this on a much larger scale, like you mentioned. But it also opens a door for other nations to fund the rebels and fund other people in Syria. And that's also dangerous because there's a Bible prophecy about Europe getting control of Syria. And with America leaving and with this very volatile situation, this is opening a door for that prophecy to take place.
Yeah, I mean, if you're on the rebel side, I guess you want somebody that's going to give you more than talk. You want some real power there. I don't know if that's how that'll work out, but you could see that happening. So it's a really interesting write up there at Commentary Magazine. Aleppo's fall won't end the war. It's just an ongoing disaster over there in Syria. Not a lot of time left on today's program, but we can at least mention this last story. It's really interesting. We don't have a lot of time to get into it, but it's from The Hollywood Reporter, my go-to source for headlines. But it's an interesting write-up. Locked and Loaded, it says the NRA and the entertainment industry interact publicly like they're mortal enemies. You always have the celebrities, they cry when somebody's killed with a gun, and we got to get rid of these guns. Of course, in their movies, they're shooting guns like nobody's business. It says, but as the number of weapons shown in movies and TV steadily increases and stars like Matt Damon and Angelina Jolie make fortunes wielding guns on screen, a codependence that keeps both churning is revealed, making the liberal bias a lot of money. So they're making their money with these movies and TV shows. And they go on. There's a lot of interesting information here. We don't have time to get into it, but there's a whole company that makes all these weapons for the Hollywood movies. They say it's a class of artisans sit at crossroads where the guns meet Hollywood. They're called armorers, and they have one foot firmly planted in each world. And they say until they stop making films and outlaw weapons altogether, we're going to keep doing what we've been doing, says Greg Bilson Jr., president of the American Entertainment Armorers Association and head of the Independent Studio Services, one of Hollywood's biggest prop houses. So this is a big business. It's a family-owned business, and they rent everything from Chinese takeout containers to canoes for these movies, with more than 16,000 guns in its arsenal, nearly all real, by the way. This company, ISS, is the largest armory in Hollywood. About 80 of the guns at the NRA's Hollywood exhibit are on loan from the ISS. They have these guns from famous movies you can go look at. Bilson's crew of armorers and gunsmiths helps finicky directors from Michael Mann to Oliver Stone find and use historically appropriate weapons, train A-list actors like Bradley Cooper, Johnny Depp, and a few others, and how to wield them safely and shepherd complex projects to completion. They say you can't have a modern movie without a car rolling down the street or someone taking out an iPhone. 75% of the time, there's at least one gun involved. They say we're just telling a story. Sometimes it's told with a meal and two actors. Sometimes it's told in a hostage standoff. So they're kind of saying, hey, we're just going to give you what you want. And there's a lot of guns in these movies. They say need dozens of AK-47s? No problem. How about a range of Glocks for a police procedural? It's all available in the weapons department, and if it's not, they'll make it for you. And then they stand on the other side, the actors, and cry over the gun violence. Why don't you put your guns down first in those movies?
Yeah, that's the massive hypocrisy, is that a lot of the violence we seek is motivated from popular culture. Music, violent music, violent movies, video games, all that media that really inspires that kind of behavior. And it's because of the make-believe that kids see or young people see they want to recreate in real life, and that's dangerous.
Yeah, they'll sit there sometimes, some of these different celebrities, and lecture everybody about weapons. I don't appreciate them coming on my TV on a commercial and shooting somebody.
Yeah.
In front of my family. They say between 5,000 and 7,000 of this company's weapons are in circulation. On one day that the Hollywood Reporter visited, carts were packed with guns marked for delivery to such popular shows as Pretty Little Liars, Preacher, Shameless, and Scandal. They're making a fortune. Selling the movies, selling the guns, and then on the other hand saying, oh, everyone get rid of their guns.
Yeah. Well, and just the gruesome violence, too, is becoming more mainstream. I mean, it's bad enough when we see it in real life, but when every hit TV show is just, even some shows about serial killers and about the worst type of things you can think of, and they're making millions off of that. I mean, you have to try to find what the source of it is, or part of the problem, and that's a huge part of it.
A majority of gun owners are very responsible, use it for hunting, target practice, sporting, but the people on TV aren't. They're the ones murdering everybody.
Yeah.
For everyone to see, and yeah, doing it in pretty grotesque ways. So anyway, really interesting write-up. There's a lot more to it there, but it's just some of the hypocrisy. But they'll say, hey, doesn't affect anybody, right? Well, sure. That's it for today, this week on Trumpet Radio Live. Have a great weekend. Stay warm. It's going to be cold in the U.S. Thanks for listening here in the U.S. and around the world. 101.3 KPCG online, kpcg.fm.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG.